All right, we are going to start the conference committee for the Transportation Finance Bill, House File 4. Welcome, everyone. Sorry, we're a little bit late. We were just typing up some notes from our productive discussion this afternoon on public-private partnerships. But Mr. Chair, why don't we kick off with the cell phone while texting matter, kind of work through that and get that off our plate. So members and the audience, I believe the circumstance is that the House, right? House is carrying the language. And where is that? R80. So R80, the House has Section 23, which provides for a second or subsequent violation of cell phones while driving a higher fine than would otherwise occur on the first violation. And that is being carried in the Senate in the Judiciary Conference, but I guess there was a decision made at loftier perches than ours that we would pick up this provision and carry it, and then we get to go crazy and spend the money that that comes with it. Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, we have an amendment to propose. Okay, so I guess this amendment would just simply add the Senate language to the side-by-side. So this is the A36 amendment. So Senator Kent will move the A36 amendment, so we'll just get it into the side-by-side report, and then we can have a discussion about what exactly we want to do with it. That doesn't mean we're adopting this language. There you go. So, like I said, this doesn't actually cause it to come into the conference committee report. It just causes it to be placed in the side-by-side, I guess, and then we'll have our discussion. So, all in favor of the A36, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Okay, so maybe counsel can help us understand the differences.
Mr. Chair, there are a couple of differences between the House and the Senate version. The House version has both deal with second and subsequent violations of the anti-texting law. The House has $150 plus the amount specified in the uniform fine schedule, which currently is $50. So the total would be $200, but if that underlying amount were to change in the future, obviously the total would change as well. The Senate simply establishes a fine of $300. For second and subsequent offenses. So the fine is higher, and it is not tied to the payable amount. And the other difference is just the structure of the sentence. The Senate version says a person who violates paragraph A shall be required to pay a fine. The House is a little bit different. A person who is convicted of a violation must pay a fine. So those are the differences.
Ms. Berezovsky, What is the distinction between violates and is convicted?
Mr. Chair, I have a letter in my email from Janet Marshall of the court who was trying to explain it to me, and I don't know that I totally understand it. This is language that the Judiciary Committee came up with, but apparently the Senate language is what works with the court e-citation program. And I don't really know, you know, if there's a difference in meaning or not.
Okay. All right. Discussion, members. Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. That was my same question, too. So it would indicate that if I violate this statute here, but I'm not caught, I still need to pay the $300 fine. But I'm wondering how I would know where to pay it to. So I was, that is a good question about violation versus conviction.
Right. I think, unless Ms. Berezovsky corrects me, I think if you violate, it presumes you're someone notices and they say so, unless you just want to show up somewhere and hand someone $300. So, but yeah, there is something about this. I don't know if anyone is here from the courts or from some official entity that can help us understand if we should use violates or is convicted of. No one's springing to the table. All right, we'll just have to figure it out, I guess. All right, any more discussion? Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, in further discussion, you know, one of the big differences is that when you're convicted, you actually go in front of a court and you're found convicted, whereas a lot of times fines, you aren't necessarily assigning yourself guilt, you just are paying the fine, and so violation is probably the word that they like using because of that, but I just thought it was kind of a strange terminology.
Yeah. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, it is a payable. This offense is a payable, so a violator is given a ticket and can just simply pay the ticket without a formal court appearance and conviction.
Okay, very good. All right, further discussion, does anyone? Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have the language on the existing statute that where the first violation is?
Yeah, Representative Howe, I guess that's paragraph A. No person may operate a motor vehicle while using a wireless communications device to compose, read, or send an electronic message when the vehicle is in motion or a part of traffic.
And Mr. Chair, the fine is in the fee structure then, I take it, or wherever they get that, and so what we're trying to do is just add language on the second and third offense. So why
So Representative Howe, yes, I think on the first offense, Ms. Berezovsky, what is the fine?
Mr. Chair, the first offense is the fine according to the Judicial Council schedule is $50. And then, of course, there's always that $75 statutory surcharge that would be added first or subsequent offenses. So the basic offense is $50.
And Ms. Berezovsky, under the House language, I was kind of only half listening when you explained, it would be $150 plus the $50 plus the $75.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. $75 is a constant on every violation.
Right. Little surcharge we added a few years ago to balance our budget. We can't seem to get rid of. All right. So, Mr. Chair, I know you had some opinions you expressed in conversations earlier today and days past.
Yes, Mr. Chair, a couple of things to note. One of the items is, in hearing from the courts, the verbiage from plus the amount specified in the uniform fine schedule was simply to make sure that the courts are compensated for this. So that's where that language came from. The other piece was simply we did have this discussion in regards to $300 versus $150 in committee, and we just felt that the $300 was getting exorbitant for this offense. So that's why the House moved that to the $150 level. in hopes of working together here, I guess we would be agreeable to going to, you know, splitting the difference here and going to the 225, but I think it would be still important to have the amount specified for the courts as well, so that they are so that the court costs are covered as well.
So what I hear, this is the proposal I hear. So what I would propose is we use the person who violates paragraph A, because apparently that, according to the courts, works with their system, their e-citation system, that we would reduce, we would increase the house fine, but reduce it in the Senate proposal to 225, but then pick up the House language plus the amount specified in the uniform fine schedule established by the Judicial Council.
Mr. Chair.
We take Senate, compromise, House. Representative Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move into the world of compromise, if I could just speak for a moment to the topic of the amount of fine and sort of the purpose. As we all know, there's plenty of research now that shows that texting while driving is a significant impairment to people's ability to drive safely, and it poses a risk not only to themselves and their passengers, but to the rest of us on the road. When I worked last session on the work zone safety bill, Senator Earhart carried it in the House, Representative Earhart, sorry, one of the things that was very compelling was that MnDOT had done a study and looked at, in the case of work zone safety, what level of fine actually provided a real deterrent in terms of changing people's behavior, and in that case getting them to slow down in the work zone around workers. And the number that they found was $300. And so I would just say, for the sake of, you know, based on that research and consistency, that if we were really meaningfully trying to get people, after they've already been found to have had this offense in the first place, now they're doing it at least another time, that if we're really trying to deter them, we should have a serious deterrent. So I would submit that, you know, it's worth keeping the $300 in mind.
All right. The speech for the Senate. Fine. All right. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, because we know there's this also a $75 court fee plus the $225, that does bring it up to that $300. So you can make the argument that, that even our compromise would maintain that $300 threshold.
Plus, I think the $50. So you get the $50, and then the additional $150 plus the $75. Right. So you're getting up there.
Yes, we are actually over the $300 to be closer to $350.
Mr. Chairman, are we here talking about $375 in the Senate position, or what here?
So the Senate position would be
$375.
What about the 50?
It's included in the
300. Oh, it's wrapped into the 300. Yeah. Okay. Yes, $375. Representative Earhart. All right. So, does anyone want to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we reduce the fee structure to $225.
All right.
And yes, and have the court language added, or keep the court language that says plus the amount specified in the uniform fine schedule established by the Judicial Council. That would actually put that total fine at $350 versus $375.
All right. And then, Mr. Chair, can we pick up the other language that the court prefers, which is in the Senate, a person who violates paragraph A, and that would replace a person who is convicted of a second or subsequent violation. I'm sorry, It would replace the person who is convicted of, and we would put a person who violates paragraph A.
Right. And Mr. Chair, just a clarification from Ms. Borzowski. From the courts, you were to understand that that language allows for someone who has violated to simply pay the fine and work within that system as opposed to being convicted. Is that your?
Mr. Chair, yes, I asked that specific question too, whether either the House or the Senate language would require a court appearance, and the answer was no, that it would be a payable under either version.
But for some reason they preferred the Senate language, and remind us again why.
Mr. Chair, I'm not really that conversant with their terminology, but they distinguish between violating language and charging language. And they prefer violating language for a payable such as this because it simply enters, they're able to enter it into their e-citation system. There's no ambiguity about it. And then otherwise, I don't think that they had any preference beyond that.
Okay. All right. So it's a slight preference for the Senate language, even though there's probably no practical real-world effect for the violator. There sounds like there's some back-of-house kind of bureaucratic real-world difference. So if I can restate, it would read... The amendment would read, a person who violates paragraph a second or subsequent time shall be required to pay a fine of $225 plus the amount specified in the uniform fine schedule established by the Judicial Council. All right, any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So moving on to the discussion of public-private partnerships. What I thought I'd do, Mr. Chair, is I created a little discussion outline that, can we pass that out? All right, so everyone should have that at their place. And what it is really is just a quick little walkthrough of the side-by-sides. And those can be found on R132 through 137. And thought I would maybe pause at some of the points of differentiation between the House and the Senate, have a little conversation, see how the committee feels about the different elements for the purpose of taking a little direction, the goal being to actually bring back an amendment to propose to the conference committee sometime in the not-too-distant future, tomorrow or the next day. Mr. Chair, and I'll have the Senate counsel maybe help us with this. Do you want us to do it?
Pardon?
You're better at it than I am.
The language or your notes?
Why don't we go off my notes? And anything else you want to fill in. So we'll have counsel, though. She's just better at this than I am.
Mr. Chair, then I'll refer probably both to the side-by-side and Senator Dibble's PPP discussion outline. Both versions of the language establish a pilot program, and both call for up to three public-private partnership agreements to be undertaken by MnDOT and the Met Council. And the language does not specify which agency will do one, two, or three of these projects.
So I'll just pause there. So I'm going to jump in and pause you from time to time. So the a concern articulated by one of the stakeholders was that one or the other, but mostly MnDOT, might like hog up all three of them, and then the Met Council would not have the opportunity. So an idea was to limit any one agency to two, so leaving one for the other. So that's just a thought there. If anyone wants to react or respond. MnDOT was there, and they said it's highly unlikely that that would happen, that they would have three. All right.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, on both sides, there is a there's some language at the bottom of 132 that talks about the reasons for this type of procurement method, and the Senate has language that says that utilization of these partnerships is a recognition of the importance to the state of an efficient and safe transportation system, necessity of developing alternative funding sources, and so on. So that is Senate alone language. And in that same paragraph at 93.19, there's a reference to public employees with the requirement that an initiative under this program take advantage of expertise and experience of public employees and the private sector as well. And the public employee reference is Senate alone.
And so, Mr. Chair, I don't know how important the kind of those first few sentences are in the Senate side only. And then we have, you know, the common language, you know, that must take advantage of the expertise and experience. I think that's useful language to continue to maintain. And then the rationale for including public sector employees' expertise is probably a little self-explanatory. It's also to make sure that our public sector employees are included, and to make sure that that we're not forgetting about labor and its interests in establishing public-private partnerships. So that's the rationale for that inclusion of that language. That came in a little later in the last few weeks.
And then, Mr. Chair, on the top part of R-133, there's a significant difference between House and Senate, and that is in the mechanism that will be used, or that can be used, for one of these projects. And on the House side, it's limited to the mechanisms that are stated at 56.3 to 56.5. And they do not mention any sort of toll financing mechanism. On the Senate side, the mechanisms stated are just examples. There's no limitation in statute as to the type of mechanism that can be used to fund a public-private partnership agreement. There is a mention of toll facilities and also BOT and BTO facilities, which are two types of toll facilities or arrangements with the private entity, and that's build, operate, transfer, and build, transfer, operate is what those signify. And then also that very first phrase on 93.22 on the Senate side, notwithstanding Minnesota Statute Section 160.98, this is a statute that prohibits private ownership of a highway for toll purposes. So the fact that the Senate is contemplating the use of tolls as a possibility for these agreements necessitates the reference to 160.98.
So, Mr. Chair, this would be a more substantive discussion. Did we hand this out to the definition? So the definition of BOT and BTO was handed out. So a BOT is build, operate, transfer toll facility, and that means that a private operator would hold title to the facility, subject to a development agreement. The title would be transferred back to the public sector when the term has expired. BTO means build, transfer, operate, and that means that it would be designed and built by the private operator And then once the once it's constructed, it would fall under ownership of the public entity, and then be operated by the private interest for a period of time, you know, with tolling, of course, being a source of revenue. And then we see a couple of other items mentioned only on the Senate language. Street improvement districts has been fairly controversial in the Senate, and a street improvement district proposal has failed a couple times now, so probably not a viable option. And then there's the tax increment financing districts for transit, again only in the Senate language. It would be unusual for, I don't think we've ever had a TIF district established by anything other than a local unit of government, so again, I don't know how operative that language would be. But the real discussion is the discussion of tolls, and whether or not we think either the Senate or the House. I mean, I know that at some point along the way, this tolls was specifically removed in the House language. It really hasn't come up on the Senate side in the context of this particular discussion. It has come up in years past, where the Senate, you know, different Senates have, previous Senates have seen fit to give a thumbs down to the idea of tolls. My sense is that the kind of unified opposition to that idea is diminishing, at least in the Senate. Don't know about the House. I think these are pretty fundamental. Particularly, I'm not crazy about the BOT idea, but certainly for the BTO concept, because I'm more interested in public ownership of these facilities rather than private ownership for a period of time of these entities. But the tolling element would be pretty important, because that would be the kind of the secured new revenue source that would allow for these entities to come in, create a business plan, a business model, provide for the financing and the construction and possibly the operations and maintenance of the facility. We don't think we can cross that threshold or overcome that. Don't know how far we can even get. I mean, we could pass something, but I just don't think any proposals would come into the state. So I don't know if my colleagues have any sense of where the Senate is on the subject of tolls. I mean, we've seen fit to support high occupancy tolls. Those are kind of a different beast. They're, you know, they're kind of an optional thing that people can take from time to time to bypass the general purpose lanes. But tolls, you know, tolls themselves, you know, to cross a bridge or to get through a particular corridor, we haven't ever seen in Minnesota. So what do you think?
Mr. Chair, I think that is a discussion that we can have in a short time period, and I do understand the impetus for the toll facilities and the need for them. I'd also just comment on the BOT and BTO facilities. If we are going to think outside the box from in respect to financing options, I think we also need to understand that is part of the thinking outside the box for an operator or owner in that regard to be able to operate and transfer as well. So I think we need to be open to that. But I completely understand what you're saying in regards to tolls, and I think we can have a quick conversation on that between the time period we put a proposal together and get back.
Very good. And just, you know, some of these other elements, you know, that there's, I think we already have some pretty well-established authority to enter into PPPs with some of these other elements: user fees, construction payments, joint development agreements. Negotiated exactions are, I just kind of explained in the notes, that's just a negotiation for like a one-time capital contribution from a nearby benefiting property or developer. Sounds so miserable. Negotiated exactions. We joke that it sounds like extractions. air rights developments. These are things that, you know, it's good to keep them in the proposal, but they kind of exist already. The real magic sauce here is the tolling. All right.
And Mr. Chair, I would agree with just your comments in regards to the street improvement districts or the tax increment finance, that would probably be language we would want to remove there, just to make the process proceed there. We do know that is a sticking point. And the only other item, just as we're on this paragraph, 93.24, existing public-private partnership mechanism, and then that second part says, or any proposed mechanism that proves best available options for the state. I think that's rather ambiguous and don't really quite understand what that would even mean. It seems like we're opening up to things that we haven't even, don't even understand or discussed. So I would suggest that piece be removed as well.
Very good. Representative Peters.
Yeah, thank you. Also in 93.26, where you talk about those mechanisms, when you say, but are not limited to all those others, then that opens up everything else that would have been excluded as well. So I'm not sure if you really intended that or not, but when you say not limited to, then you pretty much limit it to nothing. So.
Thank you. Bake sales. All right. Thank you for that input. Ms. Berzofsky.
Mr. Chair, then the next point of comparison on our 133 is the consistency with agency plans, and the House speaks of projects that are not inconsistent with MnDOT or the Council's most recent transportation plans, and the Senate specifies the MnDOT's most recent statewide transportation plan and the Council's most recent transportation policy plan. And those are the determinants of consistency. Then, let's see, both sides have provision for receipt of an unsolicited proposal requiring a publication of notice in the State Register for 2 weeks and then a 120-day period after publication to accept additional proposals for the same project.
So, I mean, we have some notes at the back about some of the stakeholder items that came up in our discussion, but if I think of them, I'll bring them up as we go along. There was some discussion brought up by the Center for Environmental Advocacy about whether or not to use consistent with or not inconsistent with. And we kind of noodled over that a little bit and what the implications of each were. And I see Mr. Urkel is here. He can expand on that maybe later when we take testimony. And then there was some discussion about, I think, some healthy discussion that we'll take as well advised on when an unsolicited proposal comes in. Certainly, there's agreement that the language reflects that we want to allow for sufficient time for competing proposals to be submitted as well. That's healthy. That's proper. But then there was a lot more detail provided about what exactly that looks like. And the types of notice, where things get noticed, how much time expires, et cetera, et cetera. And there are some good ideas contained in those suggestions. All right.
Okay. Mr. Chair, there's similar language on both sides about not entering into a non-compete that would inhibit future infrastructure projects. Then on House paragraph D 56.21 and Senate paragraph C 94.23, both houses contemplate the possibility of a transfer of ownership of the infrastructure, and both require that any contract provide for a specific period of time after which title must return to the public. And but the House states that that period of time cannot exceed 25 years.
So very quickly, so I think, you know, the House language, you know, that these are infrastructure projects, capital in nature. No one seemed to be anxious about excluding using these resources for the purchase of actual rolling stock. There was concern about limiting the amount to $100 million. MnDOT's analysis was that that would probably eliminate anyone from coming in to making a significant proposal. The suggestion was either go to a higher amount or not specify. Definitely strong agreement on my part, at least, on keeping the non-compete, prohibiting non-compete agreements. That has been a big mistake that's been made in other states. Just for everyone's benefit, what that means is when a facility is developed, in some states what they've then done is prohibited any of the nearby corridors, arterials, collectors, whatever, from themselves being improved in the nearby communities, because then those are viewed as competing with the facility that generates revenue, forcing everyone into that facility and not giving anyone any, and it creates all kinds of congestion in the nearby communities. It's a mess. It's a bad thing. It really dampens public support for these ideas. So no one's doing that anymore. It's important to have this in the law, just to send a clear signal to proposers that they can't negotiate non-compete agreements into these contracts. And then, yeah, you know, more discussion about public ownership and its advisability and that sort of thing. I think I expressed my views on that, but I express yours, and I'm flexible. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, then at the bottom of R133, there's very similar language on both sides that restricts public-private partnership projects to existing infrastructure, unless or added capacity to existing infrastructure.
And that, Mr. Chair, is to avoid the, again, we agree, so I don't need to dwell on things that we agree on, but that's to avoid, again, a key mistake that's been made in other states when they've sold an existing facility to a private operator and also traded away their authority and their ability to look out for the public's interest, ended up with a lot of really bad unintended consequences, and also the public gets very, very upset about those sorts of things.
Mr. Chair, then moving on to R134, the House requires the Commissioner of, requires MnDOT and the Council to consult with various named parties from the government and from other interest groups, and we did find out today that there is no more Central Minnesota Transportation Alliance. That's on both sides, so I guess that language will be dropped at some point. The Senate establishes an independent oversight office, the Joint Program Office for Economic Development and Alternative Finance, and it includes basically the same parties as are named on the House side for consultation. And the Senate also includes the County's Transit Improvement Board as a member of this new office. And the office is required to review the proposed projects and review any agreements to ensure that any agreements serve the public interest. And that is Senate-only language relating to the office's duties, I see, and then the House requires consultation for the same purposes. Then Subdivision 5 on the House side and Subdivision 3 on the Senate side require consultation with one or more consultants for proposal evaluation. And the language details the type of expertise that the consultant has to have in these types of projects evaluation.
So, Mr. Chair, a couple things. One is, it's just kind of a different approach in the House versus the Senate. An office is established, consultation required in the House. no strong feelings about what that exactly looks like. In terms of the evaluation and selection of private entity and project, again, these are pretty much identical in either side. The opportunity here is to be responsive to some of the critique and ideas from the contracting community, where we provide for some external objective analysis that validates project as well as private entity selection. So somewhere in here we can deposit some of those ideas. And then did we already conclude all this?
No.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, then the next part, which is paragraph B on both sides, begins to list the criteria that must be considered by the commissioner or the council in evaluating the entity, the private entity with which to enter into a PPP agreement. And these relate to, in great measure, they relate both to the project and to the entity and its ability to carry out this project, as well as various characteristics having to do with the project.
And a concern articulated is item number 9 on both sides, any other criteria whomever deems appropriate. A little bit blue sky, a little bit loose. Some suggested language coming in from the contracting community about how to tighten the screws down on that a little bit that seems appropriate.
Then, Mr. Chair, at the top of R-135 on the Senate side, there is Senate-only language that that gives it explains that the office has to review the proposals and evaluate them to ensure that all the requirements of the law are being met. The office must first determine whether the project serves the public interest. And then the language lists the considerations that are relevant in determining whether the project serves the public interest. Once that that public interest determination is made, then the proposals are evaluated according to all of the stated criteria.
This is kind of an extension of the office slash consultations duties and responsibilities. Another opportunity to make sure that there's an independent kind of verifiable analysis being done. MnDOT did suggest a couple of other criteria be included: environmental impacts, public health, and had another comment, but I've forgotten what it is. So those are some of the comments and some of the discussion we had on that piece specific to the Senate language.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the next subdivision on both sides has to do with the agreement, and beginning on 5725 on the House and 9528 on the Senate side, down to almost the very bottom of the page, there are required provisions that must be included in a public-private agreement. And those are identical except for technical differences and except for number 9 on the Senate side, which is the extent and nature of public employee involvement. Then beginning at the bottom with paragraph B, there is a listing of permissive or permissible provisions that can be dealt with but don't have to be dealt with in the public-private contract. And those also are identical except for technical differences. And then on the Senate side, on R-136, beginning at 97.2, is Senate-only language that requires the office to review the contract before execution to make sure that it serves the public interest and that it is legal and follows the law in every respect.
So, Mr. Chair, I don't remember exactly why the first 10 or 11 elements, 11 on the Senate side, 10 on the House side, are required, and then the subsequent 14 elements are permissive. But as I sit here and think out loud, the additional 14 look pretty important. So, you know, I'm contemplating maybe strengthening that language. Instead of the word may, you say strongly suggests, or maybe we just bring it into a requirement that those elements be considered as a part of any contract with the private entity. The other comment I was going to make was, the other comment I was going to make was that there was quite a bit expressed by the contracting community about some of these elements of the agreement. We'll get to those in the notes later. Particularly around protections for payment, both for contractors and subcontractors, protection of proprietary and trade secrets, allowance for payment of stipends for for proposing projects, assurance that a successful proposer's project team stays in place, so there's no sort of like bait and switch that sometimes occurs in public-private contracting. Some of the indemnification provisions are a little loose in their view, and so this is a place where we can address some of those concerns, either specify with specific language or make sure that those elements are touched upon clearly in legislative direction when these contracts are drawn up. And then again, we have the office kind of making sure that all of these elements are adhered to before the contract is executed, that Senate language proposal.
Mr. Chair, at the bottom of R-136, very similar language, in fact identical except for technical difference, that federal funds should be utilized or may be utilized in these projects, and in fact that the authority who is running the project, the public authority, should maximize non-state funds, the use of non-state funds in these projects, and funds from any level of government as well. And finally, there is reporting, and that is similar except that the House terminates the reporting in 2019 and then expires the authority, the House expires the authority to enter into any new agreements on June 30, 2019. The Senate requires reporting beginning in 16 and annually thereafter, but it does not terminate the reporting requirement or sunset the authority.
All right. Mr. Chair, I think a sunset is a good idea. Always is on these sorts of things. And the reporting stuff is kind of technical. I think continuing the reporting if an agreement is entered into should continue because the agreements, you know, the project will exist beyond 2019. I thought I would just go over very quickly, and you can see in your notes, I tried to capture some of the input, but we'll invite folks forward to testify as well because I don't want to represent other entities' points of view. But as best I can remember from the notes I took, and Representative Petersburg or Representative Earhart, who are also there, can help me. And I touched on some of these already. So the contracting community talked about, again, making sure that they get paid, particularly if the public sector is not making good on its promise. We had some pretty robust discussion about what that means in terms of risk transfer, because some of the power of public-private partnerships is transferring risk from the public sector to the private sector. So where does that risk, how do we avoid the kinds of risks that we do want to transfer, avoid some of that risk from coming back and landing in the public sector? That's a big mistake that some public entities have made around the country, is accepting that risk back, and that shouldn't happen. But this was we clarified that this is a little bit outside of that idea. Again, we talked about making sure that the review and selection process is thoroughly objective and unassailable, and that, of course, touches on some of the criticism we've had and some of the best value. I think improvements have been made, and we're on track with that, but there have been some criticisms in the past. There was a proposal to separate entirely the acquisition of financing and then the acquisition of the construction elements of a project. And we talked about that quite a bit. Thought it was agreeable to hold that out as an option for how we construct these projects, but not make them the sole method, because that would most definitely cause a number of proposers to simply bypass the state. Talked about allowing for the payment of a stipend for project proposers. That would, of course, if they agree to that stipend, some of the information contained in their proposals, so we have this already, would then become the property of the Department of Transportation, and some of those better ideas could be utilized in the successful proposal. But also allowing for protection of proprietary and trade secrets where appropriate, making sure a project team stays in place, preferring tolls only, availability payments, that's what some states do, called availability payments. That basically is an agreement that we will appropriate dollars to pay for either the construction or the operation and maintenance of the facility on into the future, and of course can never bind a future legislature, and so that becomes a slightly less secure, more risky form of a financial arrangement for the private sector. And then I touched on the indemnification provisions, some discussion about that, and the subcontractors conversations related a lot to what we hear a lot about between the primes and the subs, and you know, they want to be sure that they get paid for their work. MnDOT raised a number of issues that I touched on already. The cap on the financial size, the environmental impact considered in project selection, and as well as the public health. Oh, yeah, and 25 years not being a long enough term for private ownership. And then, like I said, the Center for Environmental Advocacy concerned that this would be exclusive of existing forms of public-private partnerships, and then we would shove out some of the things that are allowable and or might be on the boards. Talked about making sure that Met Council could participate and wouldn't be eliminated, and this consistency with existing plans item. Anything else? Representative Peterson.
Yeah, just a quick, one other minor comment was the question of whether or not this would be treated as a public project or a private project in regards to transparency of notice of payments and that sort of stuff was just an inquiry that some had to make sure that there was a way for subcontractors and others to know when they might be able to get paid. So.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else, members? All right. Questions, comments, reactions?
Just a couple of thoughts, Mr. Chair, is just as we talked about the last section there and creating an office, I think that was one of the things that we had some consternation about in regards to just the pilot program where the department, we feel the department could certainly handle the process here without creating a little more bureaucracy just for the pilot program. Mm-hmm. So that's one note. And then the other one was just you did note I think it was line item 9, in both for the selection process as being, again, somewhat ambiguous, and I would suggest that in our section 14 and our 136 is the same, very permissive, we say any other terms and conditions. So those, even though it is in both, we definitely have I'm not exactly sure how they got through us, quite frankly. So I would suggest that would be criteria we'd want to tighten down, as you said.
Yep. Very good. Thank you. All right. Anything further, members? All right. Why don't we invite anyone down who would like to further illuminate us? What I would propose as I said, mentioned earlier, is that we would come in with a fully written up kind of amendment that we would have some agreement on before we would bring it forward. We would have an understanding of it and be mutually supportive of it before we propose it to the conference committee. All right. See Mr. Werke making his way down. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as he's making his way down here, how does the minority contractor language in the veterans-owned businesses, the minority-owned businesses, how do they play into the private partner, the P3 process? And do they still get evaluated and get a leg up on the process, or are they excluded from this process?
An excellent question. I don't know the answer. Ms. Berezovsky or MnDOT?
Yeah, MnDOT, maybe. I think it's Rich. Let me go. All
right. We've been under research.
Same. We do have a the contract is required to be consistent with all existing laws. That I recall. But Representative Howe, if we need to be a little more clear on that point, we can bring that in to the proposal. Does anyone from MnDOT have a clever answer? Mr. Peterson? Yeah, so we have a 96.4 on the Senate side, R-135. The agreement must specify compliance with applicable federal, state, and local laws, so that might capture that element. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Peterson from MnDOT. The TGB program requirements, I'm not certain whether they would apply or not. I would think that would be an optional provision for a contract reached under a P3 agreement. But the DBE program requirements would not unless there were federal funds involved.
All right. So, Mr. Howe, Senator Howe, Representative Howe, willing to entertain a language proposal from you if we need to have some belts and suspenders on that. All right. Very good. Welcome, Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good evening. My name is Tim Werke with the Associated General Contractors, and with me is Mark Becker, associate from the Fabianski Law Firm and he can introduce himself, but I wanted to just take a moment and thank the committee and thank Chairman Dibble and some members for spending some time in giving this some due diligence and a thorough review of our concerns that I brought to light last Friday in a letter to you all and some discussion that you afforded us. I think the product, as outlined by Chairman Dibble, is reflective of most, if not all, of our concerns that were brought forward. And I think if those concerns and concepts can be brought into language, we would feel far more comfortable going forward. I did want to point out, I don't know if the staff had a chance to hand out to you, but I was able to locate a pretty voluminous report from the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee at the Washington level that took a look at P3 about a year ago, and it's kind of a conceptual document and just wanted to draw your attention to it. But many of the concepts that you just walked through and the protections and concerns are outlined in that review by the T&I committee at the federal level. And in particular, I draw your attention to page 15, the last paragraph in the executive summary, where they make a statement about the fact that a thorough and attentive review by states that are seeking to pursue P3 be done, and that best practices approach be pursued as well. So, and I think we have the makings of that going forward. So thank you, Senator Dibble. Thank you, Representative Kelly, for your time and accommodation. I did want to ask if Mr. Becker could spend a minute outlining sort of our proposed approach with respect to the two-stage process as it relates to the financier or the financial element of a P3, and then the contractor who would be actually performing the construction work. So that concludes my remarks.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Mark Becker with the Fabianski, Wester, Hart & Thompson, a construction lawyer there. And so Tim asked me to lend my knowledge of P3 to this effort. And I'd echo Tim. Thank Senator Dibble for his time and understanding the concerns that the construction community has about this. The two-stage process that Senator Dibble referenced as an option, what that would entail is a competition among the financing entities first, so that the public body would understand exactly what costs are involved with that financing in terms of fees, what interest rates would apply, what the total costs of that lending facility would be over the life of the whole project. So you can compare that on an apples-to-apples basis. At that point, then, once you select the best bank or best financing, you have the competition with the construction community, the design builders, who are actually going to use those funds and give you the best bank for the buck. And so that is an option that we wanted to bring forward as solving a concern that the contractors have to make sure that that financing is in place and that basically the risk of the availability payments would be borne by the financing entity and not the contractors. And Senator Dibble referenced those in his remarks. Anyway, it's a simple process that provides transparency, allows the public to evaluate the lending piece of this in a very transparent way, and it also allows the contractors to compete on a best contractor basis and not on the best bank basis, because you already have done the bank competition up front. So that was just an idea that we had that would solve a lot of issues. Like I said, it's an option to be considered, and if anybody has any questions about that, we'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Mr. Urkel making his way down. Welcome.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I apologize for the informality of my attire, but I didn't anticipate being called on the carpet. I mean, asked to testify on these points. So I'll try and be very brief.
We're half in the Senate, half in the House. So you look fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue of the use of the word or the phrase not inconsistent with, as opposed to consistent with. I mean, the use of the double negative is sort of a curious turn of phrase, and it's really a matter of shading. You know, the question is whether or not you're actively trying to help the transportation program or whether you're just trying to not to do any harm to it as the P3s move forward. It kind of, for me, it recalls the experience that the state of California had. In 1989, they adopted a similar kind of pilot program. They authorized four public-private partnerships, just for Caltrans. Of the four were submitted. Two of them never got built. Two were built. One of those went into bankruptcy and was sold back to public agencies in about 3 years. And the point is that those projects were not very high on the list of priorities for Caltrans, and for the private firms that are moving forward with these P3s, their interest is in making a profit, and they will try and look for a place where they can make that profit, that's fine. That's their business. But the question is, if it's not even on, say, in California's experience, if it wasn't even on the Caltrans equivalent of the STIP, the question really is what exactly is happening other than chasing some dollars? And this, in turn, gets to the question of project selection writ large for MnDOT, because if you're using, if you're spending lots of time and effort to get something built through the context of a P3, you're not spending it in other places. And so the question is, you know, where should you be going? I think this is important, particularly in the context of Minnesota, given MnDOT's experience with the Elk Run interchange on Highway 52, that it may well be that you want to have something a little more direct, use the phrase consistent with rather than not inconsistent with, and that you tie it to plans other than just sort of the general transportation planning that either MnDOT or the Met Council is involved in, you know, and look at, you know, get into their STIPs and think about trying to move forward projects that are already on the list that would not move for 5 or 10 years without the benefit of the P3. That was the point I was trying to make.
So thank you, Mr. Urkel. Yeah, we kind of noodled over this for a bit, and we definitely agreed that certainly nothing should be built that is either not consistent with, or you know, or that is not consistent with any plans that are out there, by whichever phrase or whichever direction you want to articulate it, because of course you know, that's a distinct danger, that especially with the unsolicited proposals that come in the door, you know, someone has a bridge to sell you, and the temptation to chase a big bucket of dollars is huge, but then we're ending up with a project that has something we don't want or outcomes that we don't want that aren't contemplated in any of the larger planning documents or the specific project lists that we have on hand. And so we're still kind of struggling whether or not we confine ourselves to an existing STIP or if we make ourselves more open and available to you know, kind of self-initiated projects, you know, that might come in that would allow for something to occur that wouldn't otherwise. So we appreciate the advice, and still noodling and still struggling with how to approach that subject. But for sure, there's agreement that nothing gets built that is inconsistent with the plans by the Department of Transportation or the Met Council.
Mr. Chair, just two last points. The first is that I think if you talk to the Met Council, their new Office of Transit-Oriented Development is already considering several examples of joint development. Probably the one that's the furthest along is the redevelopment of what's known as the bus barn site, what's left of the old streetcar maintenance yard on Snellingen University. That's they've been trying to figure out how to move that forward. They've been having discussions with the city of St. Paul. They've been talking with an adjacent developer about how that might move forward. They also have the Central Station in downtown St. Paul. Even though the line runs diagonally through that tract of land which they own, you can look at the example of San Diego, which has three similar kinds of tracks where their lines run diagonally through that, and they've used joint development. They've developed mixed-use developments, including the tallest building in downtown San Diego. So those things are already in process. The concern is if you're only authorizing three pilots, and it really seems to work in as a way of constraining MnDOT and the Met Council rather than helping them out with figuring out how to make the P3s work.
All right. Yeah, we definitely don't want to exclude or preclude stuff that's kind of already underway, so that point is well taken as well. All right, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Urkel? All right, thank you. Would anyone else like to testify? All right, seeing no one, anything further, members, on this point? All right, so like I said, we'll be working with council. We'll take all of this advice and conversation and input, come forward with a proposal. We'll make sure that there's a lot of buy-in and comfort and support for anything we bring forward in the next day or two. Mr. Chair, are you hearing anything from people not in this room?
I would guess as much as you are, Mr. Chair, yeah. So I would assume we're on the same page.
Right, yeah. No, I'm not hearing much myself. So I watch the Twitter feed and listen to public radio and watch the TV, and so I learn most of what I find out. Once in a while, someone clues me in a little bit more directly, but I continue to be, despite the newspaper, I continue to be very optimistic. So I am. I think there's a path. All right. Anything further, members? All right. With that, we are adjourned.